Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to another episode of But Why, the podcast that's all about digging into big questions and tricky topics via honest conversations. This week we're going to be looking at optimism and I'm going to be talking to Ed Miliband. Ed has been the Shadow Secretary of State for Climate Change since 2021. He was the leader of the Labour Party from 2010 to 2015 and launched the Reasons to be Cheerful podcast in 2017. Goodness, you really are an old hand in the podcasting world, with co-host Jeff Lloyd to explore the ideas, people and movements that are pioneering change and transforming communities in the world worldwide. And also, I realise I haven't mentioned your book that I'm going to just bring into camera. You also got a brilliant book out, which I've been trying to read as I go to bed, but it's quite heavy going, actually. I mean, it's light.
Sends you to sleep, doesn't it?
Well, it's just like, oh, these are really big things to be trying to put into my brain as we go to sleep. But we'll talk about that in a second. Ed, I'd like to start with three quite silly questions to begin with.
Go on then.
How are you really? What star sign are you? And what's your favourite crisps?
Aha. So how am I really? I've become an obsessive cold water swimmer. Not so cold water now. We're recording in the morning and I managed to get my swim in this morning. So I'm feeling sort of full of the kind of, you know.
Yeah, the vigour.
The vim and the vigour and not as shivery as I was when I came out. It was only 14 or 15 degrees this morning. So it wasn't as warm as it has been.
I have such admiration. You know, I really like all these kind of well-being practices and I just can't get into cold water and I'm really disappointed with myself.
I couldn't either, but I just sort of, I don't know, it's something during lockdown and so on, I kind of got into it in the summer and then I just carried on.
Okay. Yeah, that's what people say.
But you wear lots of protective things on your hands and everything when it gets really cold. So I'm feeling upbeat.
Good. And star sign? Do you know what star sign you are?
I am a Capricorn, I think, but that's where my... No, I'm Christmas Eve, baby.
You will be a Capricorn.
But that's where my knowledge ends.
I'll just give you the top line of Capricorn.
Go on.
They are quite stoic, emotional but stoic, and absolutely tireless workers, quite traditional values, and yeah. Do you feel that?
A little bit.
Steadfast. Very steadfast.
Yeah. Yeah, work too hard.
That is very Capricorn.
Well, that's interesting. Maybe there's something to it after all.
Well, here goes. It's always an issue. Yeah, I've had
Which star sign are you?
I'm Pisces, which is a very emotional, creative. But I've got, if you want to get really into it, I've got a lot of Aries in my chart, which is very fiery. So I'm kind of always wrangling myself because I'm fiery, but I'm emotional. So it's a bit of a...
Well, there you go.
There you go. There's a star sign chat. Favorite crisp, very important.
So I'm a sort of basically a cheese. It depends whether you're talking about crisps or other snacks, but I'm a cheese and onion person. Basically, I'll go for anything cheese and onion. But then in that vein, Quavers, mini cheddars. That's my kind of.
I mean, you can't go wrong with either of those.
Yeah,
can you?
You can't. What I tend to do is not eat crisps, and then my kids would have salt and vinegar, which I don't really like, and then I eat them anyway. I really quite like crisps, actually.
So do I. I kind of don't have them in my life at that much because I have absolutely no restraint when it comes to a crisp.
Yeah, me neither, really.
And to be honest, a packet of Quavers will go very fast, and they're not a satisfying crisp. Well, good. I feel like you've made fantastic choices there. To get into the topic, optimism, do you consider yourself an optimist?
At times I do. Yes, I don't. I think maybe it's sort of Maybe it's part of the job description of being a politician that you have to, particularly a Labour politician, that you've got to be optimistic. And maybe my, you know, maybe this, maybe the Capricorn thing is relevant here, that, you know, because people all know, and you said in the introduction that I was leader of the Labour Party until 2015. I, you know, it was an election which some people thought we might win, including I thought we might win, and then we didn't win. And so you have to have, well, you definitely have to have stoicism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go from sort of, you know, if you go from being leader of the Labour Party to having lost the election and then mm-hmm. resigning, you go from sort of awaiting for your awaiting your call with Barack Obama to kind of waiting for a call from the PPI. You know what I mean? So yeah, I think I'm overall an optimistic person. I'm overall an optimistic person, definitely. I sometimes find it's tested, but I feel optimistic about. I think sort of overall, I feel optimistic about the world, even though the world has massive problems. And I feel very optimistic about people. I think one of the things that's interesting about having done the job I do is obviously, you know, I meet lots of people, some people who recognize me in the street. And, you know, I think it gives you a very positive view of the country, actually, maybe a more positive view than you'd read in the newspapers. You know, people are basically pretty nice, nicer than they are on social media.
That's so true. It's so true. And actually, I think that might account for why some of it, why lockdown was so difficult, because you become so disconnected from that. The only version of other humans is a digital one. And that doesn't, you know, no one is represented truthfully digitally.
Yeah.
So. But that's really interesting. I'm trying to fathom the idea of going from what is a could be a career highlight and you've got to hold that in your head. You've got to believe it's going to happen. I had Jessica Innes Hill, the Olympian, and she talks about that in terms of sport. You know,
yeah.
You've got to believe you're going to win, but you have to hold in your head the idea that you might not. At what time of day did you find out that you hadn't won?
Well, basically, they have a sort of an exit, what they call an exit poll at 10 p.m. when the polls close. And basically the exit poll came in and it was pretty bad.
Mm.
And these exit polls tend not to be wrong. So that was a sort of, but I mean, yeah. And it kind of came out of the blue, really, because the other intelligence we'd had been sort of relatively positive. But it's a kind of massive shock to the system. And it's also obviously a massive lifestyle change.
Mm-hmm.
Because you go from having a sort of full diary and being kind of, you know, timetabled off your feet to having a sort of blank space, really. I mean, you know, honestly, it's hard. But I kind of knew from the moment that I lost that I wanted to stay around in politics. I'm obviously still an MP, as you say, a member of the Shadow Cabinet, you know, working on climate change. Because I thought, well, I might not be the leader anymore, but I can still try and make a contribution to making the world better. And in a sense, the podcast I do with Jeff Lloyd was, you know, I spent a year or two really trying to work out what was the forum for putting forward ideas. And mm-hmm. then Jeff, who's a kind of experienced radio presenter, came to me and said, oh, what about the idea of a podcast? And that was mm-hmm. sort of, you know, that gave me optimism again.
And purpose, I think.
And purpose.
I think, yeah, which is important, isn't it?
Well, there's definitely a sense of loss of purpose.
Mm.
There was definitely a sense of loss of purpose. And actually, you know, I've got two boys who are now 11 and 12. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously they were significantly younger when I lost. That for them and for Justine, my wife, I think it was sort of, you know, there's much more of me. There has been and is much more of me than there was, if you see what I mean.
That's interesting.
I was on the street the other a few months ago with my younger son Sam, and somebody passed me by, passed me and said, oh mate, I wish you were prime minister, and then kind of walked on, and he and I discussed it, and we sort of concluded that it was better from his point of view than I was.
Yeah, that's a really important thing to acknowledge. You know, anyone with these the top flight jobs in anything, any career choice, there will be have been huge sacrifice somewhere to get there. And yeah, you know, that's an interesting concept to hold in your mind. Whose life do you most want to influence? Is it the country, or is it your children? And it's not an easy answer to give, I guess.
No, and it's sort of, in a way, it's kind of, you know, and if it had happened, we would have found a way of sort of making it work. But it would have worked in a very, you know, it would have worked in a particular way for them. I'm much more, the thing about the doing the job, and maybe it was the way I did the job, is even when I was present, I was sort of slightly absent, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just very hard not to be
consumed,
and sort of distracted.
Mm. So the podcast is one of those funny career turns. You're like, oh, this is what I'm doing, and actually I'm projecting, but only from my own experience in podcasting. It's extremely rewarding.
Yes, and in a way, I think part of the problem part of the challenge I've faced as leader is you feel you are, I felt too often that I was sort of treading on eggshells, and it, mm-hmm. and to the extent I have a personality, it was hard for it to come out. And in a way, the podcast is exactly the opposite of that, because it's a much freer form. You know, mm-hmm. I sort of immediately felt, particularly when I was a backbencher, you know, there's both control and freedom, which I didn't have as leader. And it was Jeff who said to me, look, there are lots of, and this is where the optimism does come in, there are lots of good ideas out there to make the world a better place. Why don't we try and showcase them, but do so in an accessible and not particularly party political, but just an accessible way. I certainly find it interesting, useful for me and hopefully for our listeners. It's a way of talking about ideas. And I think it's sometimes hard to talk about ideas in mainstream politics, at least to give them the airspace and the time that they might want to have. And really, the book's an extension of it.
So what have you learned about how to be cheerful, or reasons to be cheerful? What are your big takeaways over that period? Has it translated into the way you go about things?
I think there's lots of different aspects of why, of sort of the optimism reasons to be cheerful. I think that if you look at other countries, there are lots of good ideas. You know, if you think, God, childcare costs are a massive problem in this country. Mm-hmm. So many people find they are. You know, are there countries that do it much better than us? Yes, there are. Many of the Scandinavian countries, you know, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, those kind of countries. You know, you think housing's a massive problem. Are there countries that do it differently? Mm-hmm. We did this trip to Vienna, to Austria with Jeff, to the capital of Vienna. You know, it's got a really interesting sort of public housing, social housing system. Think about parental leave for fathers. Think about, you know, tackling climate change. There are great ideas from all around the world. Mm-hmm. And so part of that is partly what gives me optimism.
Yes.
I think also, and I explore this in the book, that people can often feel very powerless, but actually, I kind of believe that actually what makes political change happen is not is politicians, of course, but people demanding change. If you think about the biggest change in my lifetime, which I think is LGBT rights, it didn't happen simply because governments passed laws. It happened because lesbian people, you know, in the 1980s said, we're just not going to put up with this anymore. Mm-hmm. We're going to demand change. And that's what, and then change, you know, change started to happen. And so, and I've got lots of stories in the book about people demanding higher minimum wages, or that, you know, you stop investing in fossil fuel companies, or, you know, whole range of movements and what they mm-hmm. can do. So it's that there are good examples out there that people can make change happen in small ways and large ways. And I suppose then finally that if you look at the sweep of history, can often feel not like this, but, you know, we do see positive change happening over time.
Yes.
So I think that if I'm looking for sort of sources of optimism and what keeps me cheerful and what makes me cheerful in terms of the podcast and what the book is trying to do, I think it's those things.
So it's interesting, as you're talking, I asked my audience last night how many of them felt optimistic for the future of the country. And 95% said no.
Which is
not a good place to be. Of course it's not. I think people are disillusioned. We've all had a tough couple of years. And then I think, and I'm speaking personally, you feel like there's so many crises, or what feel like crises, that you don't know where to begin. And then because I'm trying to be an optimist, I wonder whether when we get to what feel like these lows, maybe is the turning point for uprising feels extreme, but for people to start making their feelings known.
Yeah, I mean, look, that is really, I think you're saying something very important, which is, what do people feel? Do people feel a sense of optimism? And if you look at all of the data out there, you know, do people feel that their kids are going to have a better life than them, and so on? People tend not to feel that.
Mm.
And, you know, that sense in the country, you know, is terrible and totally understandable after what we've seen in terms of COVID, what we've seen in terms of the pressures on living standards, climate crisis, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're then also right that sense of discontent has got to try and sort of spur us to find something better, to find,
mm-hmm.
you know, and if I had to describe what I try and do in a small way in politics and maybe writing this book and so on, it's trying to say there are other ways forward. There are other things we can do.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're completely right to identify that mood and that sense of, you know, people feeling, you know, well, to some extent, some people feeling quite despairing, I think.
Yeah, and I think as you're speaking, I'm thinking, what I can relate to is a lot of my peers are in what I would describe as survival mode and have been for a good couple of years. And therefore, we all know it in our personal lives, it's very hard to think big picture when you're trying to spin plates, make things work in a very granular day-to-day sense. And I sometimes feel until you can come up for air and look back, it's hard to, yeah.
I tell you what, the other thing, though, you see, that is a really interesting point. And I think then the other thing that should try and kind of make us feel that, there's a mindset issue here, I think, and I think mm-hmm. it is about politics and the way we think about politics. And that's why the title of the book is Go Big, which mm-hmm. is when you describe what your listeners are feeling, what the people you know are feeling, thinking small, tinkering around the edges is the answer is probably not going to be, is not mm-hmm. going to cut it. And I often think back to the government after the Second World War, and Britain had been flattened by the Second World War. It was, we're in massive debt and so on, but they built a national health service, you know, and a welfare state.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I think partly the book is a sort of an appeal to think big in terms of what change is possible in terms of politics. I mean, take climate, the area, the climate crisis, the area that mm-hmm. I'm responsible for. we are definitely in the decisive few years when it comes to that, because all mm-hmm. the scientists are saying if we don't act in the coming, in this decade, mm-hmm. then it, you know, it's not too late to do something about it, but it's probably going to be too late to stop global heating going above 1.5 degrees, the key 1.5 degrees centigrade, the key sort of indicator. Right, so that's daunting, but we have the, this isn't a challenge of technology as much as people think. We have lots of the technology that we need. You know, the cheapest form of power we now have is onshore wind power alongside solar power. Mm-hmm. You know, we could be doing lots more of that. If we insulated people's homes, we could cut their energy bills and cut energy consumption, cut carbon emissions, create jobs. So if we really applied ourselves to this at scale, and there's an idea called the Green New Deal, which is about this idea, not only can we help prevent climate disaster, but we can actually make better lives for people. You see, I sort of think, you know, the climate crisis is a crisis, but it is also a chance for us to think differently about how do we live. You know, are we resigned to having millions of people in fuel poverty? Well, we don't need to be. If we're going to change the way we heat our homes, have this big sort of revolution in that, surely we can also tackle fuel poverty. If we're going to change the way we travel around, not just with electric cars, but with a decent public transport system, we can change that. We can give people access to green spaces. I think there is a sort of positive vision here, and it's finding, as we rise to this challenge of the climate emergency, I think it's quite important that we offer people hope, not just like avoiding disaster. Of course, that's important, but offer people, you know, hope and a sense of a vision of something better. And I think, you know, I wasn't in favour of Brexit, but I do represent a constituency that voted for Brexit in big numbers in Doncaster, where my constituency is as an MP, former mining constituency. And I think people were, what people told me is they were voting for something better. They hoped it would bring something better. They said, look, we want a new beginning for our kids. We want a new beginning for our grandkids. And I think that feeling is there. And I think part of the biggest challenge of politics is to answer and meet that feeling.
Yes. So I'm sure there's something very truthful about that. They're reaching for a change, whether that, you know, the pros and cons of that, it just, a change felt like an actionable point, I suppose, and it's one of the very clear moments in our lifetime was the sea change. But it's not a very optimistic viewpoint, but the problem is there's this definite sense of I can do all this as an individual, but is that being met in government? And unfortunately we've seen it in such stark terms in terms of how COVID has been dealt with, and you think, I think there's a lot of the what is the point attitude, because if it's not matched up, and there's a big divide between the lives that we're living and what we see is happening in politics.
I think it's important to address this what is the point thing, because you know people will look at government and they'll think, well, if they think the government isn't of their persuasion, they're not doing the things that need doing. And that's kind of why in the book, as I say, I try and talk about some of the movements that have done extraordinary things. So just let me give you a couple of examples. 200 fast food workers went on strike in the US in, I think it was 2012 or 2013, to demand a $15 minimum wage. It was called the Fight for 15. Well, it wasn't then called that, but it became the Fight for 15. At that point, I think the minimum wage in the US was around $7 an hour. Now there are something like 20 million workers covered by that as a result of that movement. And, you know, I use that example to say, actually, you know, people coming together can fight for change and can put change on the agenda. Take this issue of fossil fuels and investment in fossil fuels. On a college campus, again in the US, a group of students started by saying their university should stop investing in fossil fuel companies. And that is now a multi-trillion dollar movement around the world. And governments have been forced to not do as much as they should, but to adopt some of those practices about where investments go and so on. So And that's true in at large scale. It's true in at sort of small local scale as well. So I think, look, I think it is easy to feel hopeless, and it's easy to feel that the world is just, you know, what can I do? Mm-hmm. And I partly, and of course, it's not just about saying you as the individual can make all the difference, because if you, you know, buy an electric car, then it'll all be okay, because that would be just telling people fibs. It's not true. But I think people coming together can have always been that. That's always what's produced change. And I think you can continue to produce change.
That's so true. That's so true. And in fact, there's a line in your book that you come back to as a kind of anchor, which is making the impossible seem possible.
Yeah.
And I think we can all relate to that in our personal lives. You know, you have these things that feel insurmountable in one way and another. You put one footstep in front of each other, you learn a bit more, you do X, you do Y, and you break it down. And I suppose that is whatever may feel like a small movement, whether that be locally or a bit bigger, can become something else.
Definitely. I mean, so when I lost the election in 2015, I went on a course that I'd grown a beard by then. Actually, I was sort of trying to hide my identity. I don't think I don't think it really worked very well. It's a classic crisis move, grow a beard. But I went on this course. It's run by an organisation called Citizens UK. They've been the big campaigners for the living wage. And it was how to do grassroots campaigns. And the interesting thing about the course is, which I found incredibly interesting and useful, is the thing that stuck in my mind was this story of these Somali British young people in Cardiff who had been come into contact with Citizens Wales, the Welsh branch of this organisation. And Citizens have a very interesting way of doing things, which is they say not how do we achieve like mega massive change, which is not really realistic for a few people to do, but how do we achieve achievable change? What is achievable change? And then how can we build on that? And so they said to these young people, what would you like to change about your community? And they said, well, we really like Nando's, but there's no halal Nando's in Cardiff, but there are in the rest of the country. And so they sort of mounted this campaign with Nando's, and it looked very unlikely they were going to get anywhere. The suits from Nando's came to visit them and were like, we can't do this. Anyway, they then persuaded, I think it was the Bishop of Cardiff, to threaten to dress up as a chicken and sort of protest outside the Nando's. Mm-hmm. Anyway, in the end, they got their halal Nando's. And, you know, these were just a few young people. And what's so interesting about some of the young people is that they've now become campaigners for kind of other things in Cardiff, working with businesses. They've won a prestigious award. So it's sort of people so, and what this course taught me was people so often feel powerless, like, what can we do? And actually, with the right tools, there are things you can do. And so you need both. You need the sort of big top-down change, but you also need the kind of grassroots change as well.
That was going to be one of my next questions, because I love the idea of these, you know, big world-changing ideas, but my instinct is in the small and the local and the community and supporting small business, because that feels actionable. And as you say, what you learn in those forums, you can scale up elsewhere. But I mean, it's a difficult time for anyone dealing in like small businesses or in our smaller world. It feels challenging.
I think it's been incredibly challenging for people across the country and for businesses too. And I think what's so interesting about so many of the businesses that I come across, and I think this is a sort of massive cultural change in business, is that yes, of course they're about making profits, but they're also about making that contribution to changing the world, so many of them, in small ways and big ways. You know, whether it's businesses that are in the sort of environmental sector or in a whole range of sectors, or for whom, you know, yes, they're making a profit, but they really care about their people, they really care about the environment, you know, people and planet, as well as profit. What can government do? I think government could be making that the lives of those businesses easier. I think it could be doing more to recognize those businesses and what they're doing. But I think you're right. I think it's an incredibly tough time for so many. Actually, I think what's so striking about COVID is so many businesses stepped up during COVID to really look after their workers, and they're now having to respond to really difficult circumstances.
Yeah, there's so many things. They looked after their workers, they pivoted and changed, you know, and as we're saying, that sometimes change is so healthy. And then the problem is you're beginning to feel like those things have ended up making your life difficult, which I think is a very challenging place to sit. You know, I've been the good boss. I've tried to innovate, and now I'm struggling. But again, scrabbling around for optimism, we do know that we have this innate thing within us to do this, to try and get together, to try and look after one another, and it's trying to make that feel like it's worthwhile and rewarded, I think.
Well, and look, I think it's good that you mentioned the experience of COVID and what business did during COVID and people too, because I think in some ways we showed our sort of true character, mm-hmm. I think, during as a country during COVID, because we did really look after each other, and we did. You know, I talk about this in the book, the number of self-help groups, the number of organizations that sort of, you know, the number of people that went into bat for other people. And I think it's so striking, this. But you see, I think in a way, part of what I'm drawing attention to is that's who we are. Mm. But that's not the way lots of our country is run. You know, if you think about the benefit system, for example, it often feels like it just assumes people are dishonest rather than honest in the way that it works. You know, and I think it's that, and you see this in the cost of living crisis at the moment. You know, people going through the toughest times and not really getting anything like the help they need. So and that is a responsibility of government. So I think in a way, the challenge of the future is to sort of, you know, hold on to that spirit we saw during the pandemic was just awful for so many people. That spirit, though, is an important learning from it, and it's holding on to that spirit, and thinking, you know, because remember all the clap for the carers, and you know, what did that say about us? That said, you know, we don't actually think that the people doing some of the most important jobs in our country are being properly rewarded for doing those jobs. And so I think it's sort of turning that into the way the country is run. You know, it's hard.
Yeah, I think you've hit on something really interesting, because if you assume the worst of people in time, that they behave in that way. We know it with our children. We know it in ourselves, actually. We know if you start a terrible internal dialogue, then you ladder towards worse things. But yeah, there's definitely, it's quite interesting to unpick the impact of the last couple of years. And that is that there are so many amazing moments. We can all think of them individually, of even personally, like when you get COVID and someone said, I'll come and walk the dog for you, or talking to neighbours. We've all got examples of it. But when, yeah, it's disheartening, isn't it, to then, there's a feeling that that it's ended up in punishment and the outcomes have been negative, even though everyone sacrificed an awful lot for the last couple of years. So it's difficult to rationalize.
And I suppose if I have a worry about where politics is, or I mean, I have lots of worries, but one of them is that, you know, from all sides of politics, people said, well, having been through these terrible times, we've got to build something better at the end. You know, we owe it to people to build something better after all this is over. And I guess I worry quite a lot that, you know, partly because of the circumstances of the financial difficulties people are going through, that whole idea has sort of been lost. You know, where is that idea now? I mean, that idea seems to sort of feel very faint and distant. And I think that is an important idea to hold on to, that we owe it, well, to ourselves and to the country, to sort of take a step back and think, well, how can we build something better than we've got? What did it tell us about the inequalities of our society, the injustice of our society, who suffered, who did, you know, all of those things, who was rewarded, who was properly rewarded, who wasn't, all of those things. And I think the danger is they just get washed away and lost.
That's fascinating, because there were those moments of clarity, weren't there? There was that real, and I do think there was that feeling that there was something, that was actually probably how we all got through it. Apart from looking after one another, you're like, oh, this, again, as what we've touched on before, there's a change afoot, and if we can hold on to it, maybe it will drive us somewhere new, and maybe it will, but because we go back into the survival mode, maybe it doesn't have the opportunity, but hopefully the seeds of it have been planted somewhere.
Yeah, I think the seeds of it are there. But they need to be nurtured, and in a sense, I think that's what sort of politics has to try and do. I the thing I sort of feel, and again, this is part of what the book is trying to say, is if you think about the country and what we've been through, and maybe this is no wonder that your listeners feel a sense of don't feel that great sense of optimism. We've been through since 2008 the financial crisis.
Yeah.
The whole convulsions of Brexit, then COVID, and then this cost of living crisis that we're facing. That's sort of four massive crises, all in the space of just a bit more than a decade. And I think in a way it should tell us something, does tell us something about all of them in different ways, tell us something about the way our societies run. The financial crisis telling us that, look, it was sort of, financial markets out of control, people just being rewarded absolutely astronomical sums for taking incredibly risky bets, which ended up falling back on the taxpayer. Brexit, I think, telling us that lots of people just felt really out of sorts and disillusioned with the way the country was run, didn't represent them. COVID showing us the deep inequalities that we had as a country, which definitely exacerbated, or I think most people think exacerbated the problems that we and then the cost of living crisis too, showing that so many people have no savings at all to fall back on, and are right up against it. And so I kind of think if that doesn't drive us to think we've got to find some better way of organizing things, then I'm not sure what is going to. I think it does have to provoke a reassessment.
Yeah, it's really important to look back over that. It's the whole of whole of my lifetime as an adult. That is exactly the landscape. And, my peers are the ones with small kids, and beginning to be aging parents. So you're in a very acute point, which kind of often feels like all the bits that are challenging about being a citizen come to a head at this point.
But that example I touched on it earlier is a really good example. This whole childcare thing, it doesn't have to be that childcare costs are astronomical, that we have a patchwork system, massive gaps, massive problems, which exacerbated by the pandemic. You just need to look at other countries of the world that get their act together and have a decent childcare system, a decent parental leave system. Yes, it requires investment, but it's not just socially the right thing to do, it's economically the right thing to do. You can take this, those things are possible. It requires boldness, and it requires hearing what people are saying about, what is, the state of their, what they find in their own lives.
Yeah. And it's that feeling that, as you're speaking, it's like, well, all these things are obvious. I know these things, the challenge across every single parent, but you don't know how much that is being translated into government and really how in touch they are with actually the reality of people's lives. And let's be honest, I'm not in a position where I am as up against it as many, many people. I know how fortunate I am, but it's challenging for everybody, isn't it?
No, I think it completely is, and in a way, I think it's you've got to think to yourself, well, it's true. I think of caring in general is let's be honest about this. You know, this was work originally done by women staying at home, and basically, what we've done is we've sort of got a kind of patchwork bric-a-brac system, which hasn't really caught up with modern reality. And it's still like, you know, it's interesting that I know I've talked a lot about Scandinavians, but but you know that they talk about social infrastructure. You know, it's like we think about investments in sort of roads and bridges and trains as investment. Yeah. We don't think about investment in childcare as investment, but it's as much of an investment, if not more, in terms of, and all the economic people say this, in terms of the return you get. Childcare early years investment makes a massive difference to your kind of success as a society. Yeah. And in a way, we've got to start thinking about social infrastructure, not just you know, investing in social infrastructure, not just investing in physical infrastructure.
Yes, exactly. These people who are caring for children and for the elderly and for the ill are literally holding society together. And I think, again, the pandemic made that abundantly clear that without this, things fall apart. But there's a whole thing about actually seeing that as the most valuable work, and not just something that happens behind closed doors, that anyone who's done extended childcare, and I'm not the main childcare provider in our house, will know that is some of the hardest work you could possibly do.
Totally.
Honestly, totally
right, and very unrewarded, and we don't take it serious. We just don't take it seriously as a either care for the elderly or care for kids. We just don't take it nearly seriously enough as a profession. You know, it's the most important, one of the most important jobs you can do. And yet we don't, I mean, that is a sort of values. That's like, and that's sort of what one of the things I'm trying to say in the book is what do we actually value as a society? Yeah. You know, how do we bind people in what I call the social contract? What do we value as a society, as well as how our democracy works?
That's true, isn't it? You know, when I'm thinking about how I go about my career, I in this stage of it, try and constantly think about what my values are and make decisions based on those values. But if as a country we don't quite know what our values are anymore, or we're not united in that, then it puts us in a difficult place. But
our values sort of, we do know what they are because they sort of came through in the, you know, I think we have a deep sense of fairness, a sense of solidarity, but it just feels such a long way from, you know, from where things are at. Look, I suppose the other thing I got to sort of acknowledge, Clemmie, is maybe one of the other reasons people don't feel optimistic is because people have doubts about whether politics can rise to these challenges, I think.
Yeah, I think
I'm sure
it.
You get that from your listeners. You know, it's like, well, yeah, these are massive challenges and maybe there are good ideas out there, but can politics, you know, there's a sense of questioning about that.
Yeah, and especially if we look back at that political landscape that you mapped out, we've been focused on these other things apart from running the country for such a long time, and it's taken up so much political time,
totally,
media, our minds, and meanwhile the bits that actually really, really implicate our day to day are go further and further down the agenda.
Yeah, look, I think that is true, and you know, I think part of it is convinced. You know, I think this thing about our democracy is really serious because, you know, it's really depressing when you knock on people's doors and they say they're not voting for you. But in a sense, it's more depressing when they say, well, I've never voted. Mm. I'm not bothered. And I don't blame people for that. I sort of blame politics and say, well, look, people just don't think it can make a difference to their lives. And I will often feel a sense of frustration when I talk to people who say that. And I'll say, well, look, it really does matter for the NHS, for your kid's school, for whatever, and they're just people just say, look, I just can't be doing with that. And when you think about the fact that I don't want to sound pious about it, when you think about people fought for the right to for people to vote and all of those things, you know, we should. I think we should worry about that.
Mm. But it's a disconnection, isn't it? It's going back to that. If I do something that I can see in the impact of on my doorstep, you know, if it was voting for something in my kid's school, in my workplace, something that would happen at my local park, of course people would get involved. But there's this real sense of these things that happen out of my, you know, way beyond me. And as we, again, the pandemic shone a light on, we're living in vastly different situations. I can think my parents live, you know, in villages with big gardens, and their experience of the pandemic versus people living in an inner city are light years apart. And how can you have the same experience? You've got different challenges. And similarly, I don't have the challenges of a rural community. But so it's difficult to end up in these apply all kind of brackets, because we're not all living the same experience.
Totally. And, you know, the disconnect, I'm always struck, you know, that there's still that there's way too much of a disconnect between what politics seems to talk about and what is, you know,
what we're living,
is happening in people's, you know, people's lives. I just see this so clearly with the you know, what people's happening to people's energy bills, and the you know, the people are just sort of worried sick about well, how they're going to afford to eat, how they're going to afford to pay their bills.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, politics is talking about it, but it, you know, that has got to be front and center of the, and how we deal with that has got to be front and center of the conversation, I think, because, well, otherwise people think, you know, it's just something that happens over there. And also, there's lots of aspects of politics that really puts people off. Prime Minister's questions, which I did, you know, 100 and something times against David Cameron, you know, it's sort of, it's kind of pretty off-putting, isn't it? Lots of blokes shouting at each other.
Well, what's interesting to me is when I said to people that you were coming on here, people are like, oh, that's an unusual one for you, Clemmy. I was like, well, and then I was like, oh, like, am I capable of doing this? And then that is exactly the problem. You know, why wouldn't I have a conversation with you, and why wouldn't we be able to find some interesting things to talk about? You know, it's this real sense of other, because, yeah, it's quite surprising, I thought.
I mean, in a way, one of the things my office used to joke about this, that they'd love to do a documentary of me on a train, because because I think the best conversations I have, well, on podcasts too, but the best conversations I have are when people come up to me on trains. You know, somehow you're sort of both a kind of slightly captive audience, and you have these amazing conversations about people's lives. And I think part of this is that, you know, as a politician, what do politicians often lack? Humility. And I'm sure that's true of me. But also, I think the other thing that we don't talk about enough in politics, and I tried to talk about this a bit when I was leader, is sort of empathy. You know, can you walk in other people's shoes? I'm not sort of pretending that I don't have a privileged life and all of that. And if I did, I people wouldn't believe me. But the point is, can you at least sort of empathize with what people are going through, and hear what people are saying to you. And I think that is, I sort of think that is, and I think we kind of underestimate, you know, walking in the shoes of others. I think we underestimate that as a, as perhaps the most important thing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, but I wonder whether, you know, my question to you, which I'll get to in a minute, is like, what keeps you up at night? But if the people at the top of the country did walk in each other's shoes, they'd have to really, really face some hard realities of the life that people are living. And we all know it, when you're faced with something uncomfortable, it's so much easier to try and shut it out. My question, actually, I will ask you that. What keeps you up at night, and how do you try and inject a bit of optimism into those concerns?
That's a really good question. I think what keeps me up at night, I'd say a couple of things. You know, I know you talked, I think it was on the podcast with Will Young that I heard a few weeks ago, you talked about anxiety, and I'm actually relatively anxious person, so I went into the kind of wrong profession for that. So sometimes, you know, anxiety about work things keeps me up at night. But if I had to say, what is it that I kind of, what is it, of all the issues that I look at in politics, and I sort of think, you know, what makes me the kind of most anxious about whether we're dealing with it or not? I do think I'd say that the cost of living thing is absolutely, at the moment, the feels like the most urgent thing, and it is. But I think the thing my kids will judge me on is whether we tackled the climate crisis or whether we just let it go and just said, well, there's too many other things on.
Mm-hmm.
And we've just got other things that are distracting us. Because I think I think there are dangers that we, there is a danger that we just leave. We leave a bad legacy. And I think the thing, you know, why am I still in politics? Above all, because I think this thing really, what we do in the next few years really, really matters.
Mm-hmm.
And Britain can show a leadership role. We can do a lot more than we are doing. And at the same time, you know, it's not like either we tackle the climate crisis or the cost of living crisis. We can do both at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
In the ways that I've described, because the green choice is now not just the fair choice, but the economical cheaper choice, you know, onshore wind, solar, energy efficiency, all of those things. And so it's sort of my mission, my sense of being in this strange world of politics still is to get on with that. Mm. And it's the urgency of doing that, I think, mm-hmm. that really matters to me.
And actually, going back to what we said, having a relatively single purpose is very, very useful because you can't do all of it at once. You know, other people can do other things at once, but being committed to a cause, yeah, otherwise you spin, don't you?
It's what you said earlier about purpose, to be honest. Mm. I mean, it's the, you know, frontline politics has got its, there are many harder jobs, but frontline politics definitely has its downsides. You know, you know, even not being the leader, what's the point in being in it to think you can try and make the world better? And, mm-hmm. you know, that's sort of why I, so my parents were, my mum's still alive, but two refugees, two Jewish refugees. My dad came from Belgium, my mum from Poland, and I think somehow being kind of, you know, Holocaust sort of survivors and having members of my family killed and so on, it gave that, they didn't sort of shove this down our throats, but I think it gave them a sense of, you've got a sort of, I don't want to sound this said too heavy, but a sort of responsibility or a duty to try and make the world a better place.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that's what they, you know, implicitly, without saying it in kind of like eat your greens way, that's what they kind of got across to, I think, us. And so I suppose that's, for me, that's the purpose. That's the purpose of being in it, really. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's like there's just too much rubbish associated with it. If you haven't got that, what's the point of it, you know?
And without putting words in your mouth, that kind of becomes your purpose, also becomes the thing that keeps you up at night, I guess. It's like, it's the same, comes from the same thing, doesn't it?
Definitely. And it's also trying to, it's, you know, it's like any job, there's always short-term distraction, small things. Mm-hmm. You know, don't sweat the small stuff. I'm not very good at not sweating the small stuff, I confess. But you know, try and hold on to these bigger prizes and the things that really matter.
Yeah.
But because otherwise, you just get caught up in the weeds of like small things, small distractions, which don't really. I think that's my, you know, that's just a work in progress for me. But, you know, I think that is sort of, when you take a step back, I think that's sort of, I think that is really important.
Mm.
And also, you know, boundaries. I mean, I didn't have it really as leader, but having boundaries so that I do, you know, see my kids, see Justine. Mm-hmm. I don't just work all the time. You know, mm-hmm. I think that is, again, that is, I'll do.
Yeah, but it's a learning. Sadly, I was at a funeral this week, and you know, you always, when you sit at those, you of course makes you look, have an idea of the zoomed out version of your life. But you know, actually, it really struck me that your only legacy is the values and the ideas and the skills that you pass on to other people. They're the guiding light. And I think for me, the skills bit was really important, because I think you can sometimes forget that. It could be teaching your kids how to cook, but it also could be instilling them with a sense of courage or an idea that they can go after things. And yeah, that was my takeaway.
And also sort of, you know, kindness to people is practicing, you know, that, I think. Mm. You know, it is... You know, individual acts of kindness to people are sort of really important, you know, because, yeah, and I think we sort of, maybe we all underestimate that in our, in our lives, because that's a legacy too.
It really is.
Encouraging people. It's particularly, I find this particularly when I meet young people who are interested in politics or want to be part of politics or stop me in the street or whatever, you know, I sort of really want to kind of encourage them and think, you know, and it's almost irrespective of which party they are, but just to sort of say, you know, it's good that you're engaged, it's good that you care. Because it's, you know, so it's harder to remember now, but it is really, as a young person, it's just so hard to make your way in the world. And in a way, it's harder now than it was maybe when I was growing up. And so I think all of that is really important. It doesn't just have to be the big macro thing. It can also be the individual acts, I think.
I think so too. And actually, whenever I do spend any time with the young people, and sound very old as I say that, I actually always end up feeling extremely optimistic.
Totally.
Like, I'm like, well, here we are worrying about them.
Totally.
And for good reason that we're worrying, but wow. I mean, wow. They're smart. And of course, the next generation will teach us so much. So again, we've got to guide them, but do so in a way that trusts them as well.
No, totally. And I think so many of the young people I meet, they have, you know, their values, their outlook on life. It's just so impressive. And I think completely, I completely concur with what you say. It's sort of, you know, it's inspiring. And maybe that's something really important to hold on to, and that does go back to optimism, is to, you know, I find that young people actually are quite optimistic, you know, about what is possible. And I think it's that sense of not feeling disillusioned, not feeling, you know, things aren't possible, but to think, you know, change and good thing, you know, that happened before, can happen again. Maybe they don't happen the first time of asking. That's kind of one of the ways I interpret my defeat in 2015. But, you know, things can change and things can be better. And I think, as you say, young people really give you that sense.
Mm-hmm. So, and I always wonder whether actually generationally everybody was worried about the world when they were at this kind of point in their lives. Maybe that's just a natural order of life. And, you know, that's not to make small the fact that there are plenty of reasons to be extremely concerned. But as you say, you have to come right out and look at history and see that we are moving in good directions.
Yeah, and there are just so many good people. You know, if you ever feel like hopeless and things can't get better, just think of all the other people you know, you come across, or at least that's what I try and think about, who are, you know, good, decent people who want to build a better world and are doing, you know, great things in their communities, in their businesses, and you know, who have those values. So it's not, you're not alone, I think. And I think it's really, really important. And I think that is definitely a cause of optimism.
I agree. I'm going to just ask you two last questions, but I'm going to leave the optimism chat there, because I think it's truth. Both you and I seem like we have a tendency to go to quite the less optimistic place, but you have to believe in optimism.
Totally.
Otherwise you get nowhere. Two questions before we go. Yeah. Where can people find you? And is there anything you want to shout about? Wow. And the second question is going to be, if you could have an honest conversation with one person, what would you be? Who would they be and what would you say?
Crumbs. those are good questions. Where can they find me?
Not on the street. I mean, like on digitally.
They can find me on Twitter, @Ed_Miliband. They can find me on Instagram. I think it's the same address. They can find my book, Go Big, hopefully at all good bookshops, as well as online. What's the thing I want to shout about? I suppose I want to shout about, you know, don't despair. Things can be better. I think that's, you know, you go through hard times. I feel like I've been through some hard times personally, professionally. But, you know, you've got to keep on keeping on. You've got to be stoical like the Capricorns. And what's the one conversation? Honest conversation. I think it would be with my dad. My dad died when I was 24.
Wow.
So more than half my life ago. And I think the honest conversation I'd have is how much I sort of miss him and still miss him. I think I'd say that he gave me some. Like all parents, he wasn't perfect, but he gave me some great values that I really wished he'd been around for longer. And also, I think I'd say, which is sort of may be surprising, because he's quite a serious person, that I try and make time for my kids in the way that he did make time for me, because he did, despite writing lots of heavy books and so on, he made time for me, and that was. You know, that was really important. So he's the person I'd most like to talk to.
Oh, I feel like that's a really great choice. Where were you at in your career when he died? How far have you gone?
I had just started working for the Labour Party when he died. So, pretty early on. There was still lots... You know, there was still lots to say.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very early part of your life, really. But this is what we mustn't forget, that even his action of making time for you will end up shaping you and the way you go about your work and the way you parent. So we mustn't underestimate all those quite daily activities, I think.
I think you're right.
There we go. We're in there. Thank you so much.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on.
It didn't stay that optimistic for very long. I think that's probably, but you know, it was honest, and I feel like it's good to be able to speak about this. I didn't know how edited or not edited I would be, but when I got that stat from my audience last night, it's really not a good state of affairs, is it?
Yeah, but I think we've got to hold on to optimism.
Yeah, I do. I definitely do. That was excellent. I warmed to Ed an awful lot, and I feel appreciative that he didn't just rebuff my suggestions that people aren't happy and acknowledge the fact that it feels like there's such a disconnect between government and the lives that we're living, which I know feels like a piece of language that we hear often, but to have that confirmed by a politician is reassuring. And on the one hand, like so many of you, I do feel deeply worried about the state of things and what our kids are going to inherit. But on the other hand, we have to remain optimistic and we have to try and believe that we can, as individuals, help move towards change. Otherwise, as we know in our personal lives, you really do lose all sense of purpose. And without purpose, it's very difficult to be optimistic. Yeah, that was a great chat. Thank you so much for listening. That's been another episode of But Why. I'm always grateful to have you here. I'm also really grateful if you share the episode far and wide. Try and get more listeners, get more people listening. It makes a big difference to me. I am now off to, I know what I'm off to do. We have recently replaced our wardrobes and my entire collection of clothes is all over the bed. So I'm going to go and put some of those away. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.